Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Today we have a very interesting program, one that we all should be very aware of. It involves children and how they become victims. I'm speaking on the phone with Deborah Fontiera. She has recently written a book titled Fight CPS, Guilty Until Proven Innocent of Child Protective Services Charges. This book chronicles 13 months of agony and frustration suffered by the innocent Bonilla and Frontiera families as a result of Child Protective Services' removal of young James Bonilla from his parents. We're going to hear from Deborah, grandmother of James, of what really happened and how the system failed. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Irene. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I'm so glad to have you online, and this is such an important topic. But before we go any further, fighting CPS, guilty until proven innocent of Child Protective Services charges. Tell our listening audience just sort of a brief outline of what this book is really about.
It's about, mainly about my family when my daughter and son-in-law were accused of abusing their son, who was not quite 2 years old at that time, and the following 13 months that we spent trying to prove that they were innocent and trying to show the agency that our son-in-law or our grandson had a medical problem. He was not being abused. And then it grew beyond that to include 10 other cases that I came to know about that where other people were also wrongfully accused. And I began to realize the scope of the problem, and I decided that the book needed to be much more than look what happened to our family, but look what happens to a lot of families, mm-hmm. and that there's so much incompetence all through the system and not just in the state of Texas, but across the country.
Now, you said that your daughter and son-in-law were wrongly accused. Who actually reported or accused, or how did this all start in the first place that CPS would get a red flag?
Our grandson began having seizures in February of 2007. And in the course of diagnosing why he was having seizures and what type of medication, et cetera, to put him on, he had an MRI done at Texas Children's Hospital. And the MRI showed that there were some head injuries, which we had been completely unaware of. He had never cried, never lost consciousness, never had any symptoms that indicated a concussion or anything of the sort. CPS came to the conclusion that a head injury was caused by abuse and that the head injury was causing the seizures. When the seizures had happened first, and it could be that, you know, he had hit his head on his crib in the night having a seizure and nobody even knew about it. We may never know where the injury came from. So, yes, they did have some cause to be suspicious because a child with a head injury is something they need to look into. But the doctor involved immediately came to the conclusion that that kind of a head injury could only be caused by abuse and did not look any farther into it and just immediately concluded that these people were abusing their child and filed affidavits with CPS and with the court.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just sitting here with my, you can't see me, of course, because this is recorded and we're on the phone, but I'm sitting here with my mouth dropped because our own child had a seizure when he was 8 years old. At that time, we didn't have MRIs. He's in his early 40s now.
Mm-hmm.
He had all kinds of tests done, and they came to the conclusion that there was a lesion on his brain. But, you know, who knows? A little child runs, falls. I mean, kids are kids. They fall. Or it could have been from birth.
Right. And, so, of course, our grandson also had the problem of he was a very tall child, always for his age, and he tended to run a lot,
yeah,
and lean forward, so he fell down and collected bruises on his forehead like ants collecting, you know, sugar crystals at a picnic. And so when my daughter-in-law and son-in-law were question, of course, it came out, well, you know, how does he get all these bruises? Well, he falls down a lot. Well, that excuse among parents who do abuse their children is about as common as my dog ate the homework to a teacher. So it was, there were just a lot of circumstances that fell together at that time that made them suspicious. But the problem was they never really investigated. I even took the results of a CT scan that he had done after the second seizure, which showed not a head injury, nothing at all, nothing in his whole little brain but a little sinusitis, which definitely proved that the seizures preceded the head injury. And they never really took that medical evidence seriously.
So I can just imagine being a parent, because I'm thinking, you know, just relating to my own son and, you know, having the seizure. And, of course, I mean, it's the first time this happens. I mean, this is panic. We get medication. We get all kinds of tests done. And, I mean, I can just imagine your family going through this, you know, the mother and the father, your daughter. And so this must have been just this devastating surprise when they came to the door, you know, wanting to take these children away, or the child.
Right, and actually it happened all in the course of being in the hospital after he had the MRI. They recalled them to the hospital under the guise that something showed up. Well, my daughter and son-in-law were in panic mode. They thought, oh, my gosh, what if he's got a brain tumor? What if him? What if that? And they're driving in the middle of rush hour traffic in Houston, trying to get back after being told to go to the emergency room, and then get there and wait for hours and hours, not being told anything, while behind the scenes they're preparing to take this child away with no explanation to the parents. When the caseworker actually told them, we're taking your child away, in some ways, my daughter said it was a relief, because I thought, oh, he hasn't got cancer. You know?
Right, of course.
You know, and but then that, of course, unleashed a whole other nightmare that lasted for 13 months.
13 months,
yep. It was almost as if the numbers were there. We had 13 months and 13 different caseworkers.
No way.
Every time we would get ready to go to court, we would be informed that we had changed caseworkers. Sometimes we would get to a court hearing and find out we had a different caseworker, who would then stand in front of the judge and say, well, I just got this case a couple of days ago, Judge. You know, I really haven't had time to look at the file. And the judge would automatically grant another extension.
So in the meantime, this child was in a foster home, obviously.
Actually, he was with us. They did place him with my husband and I in what they call kinship care.
Uh-huh.
They do, in Texas, they do like to put a child with a family member if they can, because for one thing, it saves them all the charges, all the costs that they'd have to pay to a foster family, because in kinship care, you don't get anything.
Yeah.
A lot of headaches and expenses. But he was with us, and at the very beginning, the judge had set fairly liberal visitation rights. Our daughter and son-in-law could be at our house as often and as long as we wanted, but they could not stay overnight.
Oh.
And so, you know, our daughter and son-in-law were here pretty much nonstop.
I can well imagine.
And that was a stressor, too, in a lot of ways, because they weren't getting things done at their house that they needed to do. My husband and I, you know, felt like we had company all the time, even though they were family. And even that tends to build stress. And every night, James would just cry and cry and cry because his parents had to leave him with us, and he wasn't going home, and he didn't understand. And, you know, there was no way to explain it to him.
Well, no, especially a child at that age. Well, any child, really. You know, or try to explain this to an adult, let alone a two-year-old child. My goodness. So, now, where is all this now? How old is that James right now?
James is now 6 years old.
Six. Okay, so this all started 4 years ago.
Right.
And at what place is the case now?
They non-suited the case. When they finally let James go home, they simply non-suited it. In other words, they withdrew their suit from the court. And in the court's mind, then the whole thing never happened. There was no apology. There was no, gee, we're sorry, we turned your lives upside down. There was just, okay, you can have him back now, kind of an attitude that totally disregarded anyone's feelings.
Wow. So he is home with his parents.
Yes. He is home with his parents. And that was the happy ending. And when they finally decided to give him back, it was just suddenly as they took him away. And the day that the caseworker and I drove him back to his house, once James was in his mommy's arms, I said, well, what finally tipped the case in our favor? And she said, well, I read the file, and I saw there was nothing there, so we had a staffing, and I said, why are we still keeping this child?
Wow.
They're trying not to drop my jaw, thinking to myself, read the file. Duh. You know? Why does it take 13 people for one person to finally read the file and realize that there's nothing there? You know?
My goodness. My goodness. So, obviously, you've done a lot of research. You've done, you know, gone through all this yourself as a grandparent. What is really going on with CPS? Why is this incompetency? Were there 13 caseworkers? Is there such a huge turnover, or what is really going on?
It's a combination of factors, especially here in Harris County, Texas, which is the greater Houston area. Partly it's high turnover. Partly it's that they get these sweet young women who are full of enthusiasm. I have to give them that. They're right out of college. They have no experience being parents, let alone caseworkers. And then they jump on them huge numbers of cases that they need to sort through. And they are quickly overwhelmed, and I think a lot of them burn out within a few months, if not a few years. And so that high turnover rate contributed to part of the problem. And I think these people are, I think caseworkers are terribly underpaid, almost as badly as teachers. I think they get about the same salary as a teacher, but they don't get 10 weeks off in the summer. You know?
Yeah.
Teachers, we at least, you know, because I'm a retired teacher too, mm-hmm. we at least get a little time to recharge before we have another onslaught of, you know, 8 to 10 hour working days, you know. So I think that's a part of the problem too.
Sure.
In the third section of the book, where I actually got a few caseworkers who would speak with me honestly, that was something that they brought out too. That and the fact that they have to drive their own cars around. That while they get a little bit of reimbursement for their time and travel, it's not nearly enough. So that they're coping with, you know, paying gas and extra stuff out of their own pockets while their kids around or mm-hmm. taking a child to a doctor, a dental appointment, and they're expected to do that a lot of times in their own vehicles. And I think all these things just really add up after a while, and they just drop out of the system.
Wow. So, Deborah, at any point, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of stress that happens. You know, you just can't believe that this is really happening. Did at any point you start doubting your daughter or, you know, looking for some underlying, maybe there was some underlying truth to this? Maybe this child was abused. Did that ever cross your mind?
I never doubted my daughter. The one thing that did cross my mind was that my son-in-law's younger brother was living with them for a time,
uh-huh.
and he was getting ready to graduate with high school. He was careless. I could see perhaps an accident might have happened,
uh-huh.
and maybe, you know, someone was swinging him around and clunk. You know, that I could picture, but the thing was that my son-in-law's younger brother was never alone with him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I really never doubted them at all. I knew my daughter too well. I knew my son-in-law too well to think that they would ever have done anything to him. I could see something accidental, but nothing more than that ever.
What kind of emotions did you go through yourself?
Oh, all,
all of them?
Anger, frustration, intense love.
Mm-hmm.
But the anger and the frustration would crop up the most in all of us because I would think to myself, are these people idiots? You know,
yeah.
Why can't they see? You know, and coping with that for all of us was a major, major thing. Just the stress of why us? Why me? You know, why does this keep going on? Why does it keep getting dragged? And that kind of stress really, it put a strain on their marriage. It put a strain on our marriage. It put a strain on everything that we did. And I think if we hadn't had great, great faith and wonderful from my other daughters, from my brothers and sisters, from my parents, from, you know, family all around, from friends in our church, if we hadn't had the constant support of those people and all of their prayers for us, I think we might have fallen apart.
Yeah. I mean, this would be just so devastating. And, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm also reflecting back to my own child when he first had his first seizure. And, wow, I just can't imagine what you were going through, or I can only imagine, I just cannot, you know, I haven't been there, and how do we know unless we've actually experienced this? So in your research, Deborah, obviously you have found out yet, and you had mentioned earlier that yours wasn't the only case. There are other cases that have, you know, been treated like this.
Right, and a lot of times a friend of a friend would call me and say, oh, I know someone who went through this. And I would say, well, you know, who is this person? Would you give me their phone number? And of course, sometimes people were reluctant to talk about it. And that's why in the second section of the book, a lot of the names are obviously not real, like Mr. QZ, Ms. MX, things like that, because these people were fearful, you know, what if my ex that accused me of this finds out that they're in this book, and, God, then what will they do to me?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I had to be very, very careful to protect people's identities, no matter what state they were in. But we'd talk to other people up at the courthouse. We'd run into people, you know, on the beach down in Galveston, just having a fun day at the beach. And people would say, well, I heard about, you know, this time when, and it would go on and on. And there were two extremes. Either the person knew about a child who was being abused and Child Protective Services left the child in the home, or it would be a false accusation like ours. So there's failure at both ends of the spectrum.
So is this all over with now?
Yes. Yes, it is all over with. Once they returned James to his home May of 2008, and then they had one more hearing in June of that year where the judge just said, congratulations, this is non-suited in 2 seconds, and they were done. For James, it continued a while as he regained his trust.
Of course.
He was very shy with us. He didn't want to come into our house anymore. He was afraid he'd have to stay. And that lasted about another year.
Wow.
James's medication for the seizures has been excellent. He's played a lot of catch-up. Between the seizures and the trauma, he stopped talking altogether for a while. And then we had to go through a lot of speech and language therapy. He's been in, as a preschooler, he was in what's called the Preschool Program for Children with Disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And last year as a kindergartner, he was still pretty much behind and still in that special ed setting. So that this year now, he's old enough to be in first grade, but he's a very young six. And because he's still a little behind with speech and language, he's going to have a regular year of kindergarten with just pull-out for speech therapy.
Oh, such a good
idea. So it's like, yeah, we've almost caught up. he's very bright, you know, and everything about him shows the intelligence is there. It's just this one part is lacking, and that the school district that he's in wants to support that until they feel that he's truly ready. And as a teacher myself, I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. As a parent, oh my goodness.
Right.
I'm a grandparent now, too. That's what I'm thinking, too.
Right. I had a lot of fun last year. Right. I would go up every other Friday and have lunch with him and read his class after lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the year, I would look at him and think, oh, he's not ready.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be the interfering grandparent, but I was relieved when his teachers and my daughter and son-in-law came to the same conclusion and decided to let him repeat.
That's good.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Wow, interesting, isn't it? We are speaking with Deborah Fontiera, author of Fighting CPS, Guilty Until Proven Innocent of Child Protective Services Charges. Please stay tuned because there's just so much more we're going to talk about. The system is broken. So, you know, going through all this, I mean, obviously, you know, you talked about anger and frustration. Do you still have some underlying anger with CPS and the system?
Sometimes I do.
Yeah.
I have worked very hard at getting through the put this behind me, forgive kind of mode. And I've gone through that. I've reached the point where I can say, yes, I forgive you, but I can still be angry when you do this to somebody else.
Yeah.
And writing the book was very much a part of that, of trying to get it known so that maybe politicians will begin to fix the system and maybe they'll, you know, states will begin to say children need a larger priority. We need to better train these young caseworkers. Maybe they'll begin to see that it ought to be police who do the investigating, not caseworkers. And, you know, maybe that'll prevent some other families from going through this.
Are you, at what stage are you at right now, besides writing the book? Are you advocating or, you know, do you have a group that's presenting anything to change the system?
I've been in contact with one group that is working to that end. But as of right now, I'm not in a group yet. I'm focused on trying to get the word out about the book and then possibly doing, you know, getting speaking engagements with different organizations and trying to see then what action I can take from there and what, you know, what it will lead me to.
One thought here is I'm still back on James, you know, and just kind of really feeling for this child. He obviously doesn't really know, or he's too young to understand what really happened. Is there a point where all of you as a family will sit down and just explain it to him?
Yes, and that's another good reason for having the book, is when he gets old enough that he can read at this level,
mm-hmm.
you know, the first thing his parents will do is hand him a copy and say, you know, this is you, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You might not remember it, you are too little to remember, but this is what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, this book has been out, and are you getting any controversy over it, Or are people really just saying, wow, you know, this is really happening, let's do something about it?
I'm beginning to hear a little bit. While I was still in Michigan's Upper Peninsula for the summer, I was at a festival in Marquette, Michigan, right at the end of July when I had first received the advanced copies. And I took a couple of them with me to this festival, and I was with other authors. We were all selling all of our books. And one woman picked it up and said, oh, I'm so glad somebody wrote this, but I don't think I can read it. I get angry all over again. And I sensed from that that she had a similar experience. And another woman walked by and said, well, one surefire way to not fight DBS is to not beat your kids. And just about in that tone of voice, and I said, well, some people are wrongfully accused.
Uh-huh.
And she turned away from me and said, not, and walked away. So I'm beginning to sense, yes, there will be polar reactions. And I think that's good, because anything that brings attention to an issue is going to get people talking, and if it gets people talking, maybe something good will happen.
Exactly, and that's what I'm thinking, and I'm reflecting this woman that, you know, she didn't accept what your answer was, and it makes me think that probably she was abused at some point and has not been able to talk about it. So,
right, or perhaps she knew a child who was abused and nobody did anything about it.
Or was the abuser, but it had never come out. You know, there's just, we never know. But something like this will at least get people talking, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, you know, something good will be coming out of it, and I know that's your intent. What other intents do you have now that you've written the book and it's out there? Fortunately for your family, the ending is ended up well, and the child is back in the home, and everything is stable right now, but now what?
That's a good question. I'm still involved with some of the other cases that I reported on, and I was hoping that one of them was going to have a happy ending with the child finally being returned to family, but I haven't heard from the aunt of the little girl again, and so I'm assuming that either the last hearing, which was supposed to be August 8th, went badly, or it was postponed again.
Mm-hmm.
CPS was doing some delay tactics with that case. So I'm still involved with some of the people that I spoke to and still following up. And I may start a blog off my website, posting other cases or other things I hear about to kind of keep the book ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm just kind of like speechless here too, because I'm still sort of all of a sudden putting myself into the parent's place and having a child that did have a seizure, and I'm thinking, my goodness, how much of this really does go on? How many people are really wrongly accused, and it doesn't turn out well? That the child is taken away from the parents forever, or the parents are charged, wrongly charged and fined, or maybe imprisoned.
Right, and because they don't do a lot of investigation on many of these cases, they do go unreported, and people just eventually get back a child, or they don't, and they just give up. A lot of them, because they're poor, they don't know how to navigate the system. They can't afford lawyers, and so they just have to let it go and grieve for losing that child and not have any recourse. And I'm not sure how to reach those people, and I'm not sure where I'm going to go with that. But
yeah.
The attention to this case and the attention to the problem in general may get a few politicians talking and looking at things.
I sure hope so. There seems to be a gap, and I know that there's a reason why Child Protective Services is in place, because there are children that are abused. There are children that need to be taken away from home, and they're better in a foster home or whatever, you know, wherever, whatever happens in the end. There is purpose for it, but this being wrongly accused, there seems to be a gap there. And, you know, we had talked about it earlier that, it all goes stems back to the human workers in CPS.
Right, and a lot of times they are so overwhelmed. I'm hoping that maybe some good will happen. About 2, maybe 3 years ago, in the state of Michigan, there was a lawsuit against the state because 2 children had died in foster care, being abused by foster parents.
There you go.
Yeah, and the outcome of that was that the state required lower caseworker loads and a little bit more protections, more training for foster parents. They began to require that family members who were taking in children be approved as foster parents,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes Aunt so-and-so can be just as bad as Mama.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And a lot of improvements happened as a result of that case, and I think that what happened in Michigan could be very much become a model for improvement in the rest of the country.
Well, I hope so, and obviously, as we're talking here, the system and that department needs a lot of improvement. I'm curious, while you had the custody of your grandson, did CPS actually do visits?
Do business?
Visits. Did they visit your
Very rarely. They were supposed to visit at least once a month, and it was more like every 3 to 4 months. Some of the caseworkers, we never actually met in person. You know, I would talk to them on the phone, and then by a month later, they were gone, and it was somebody else. So there definitely was not enough contact on their part with us as foster parent guardians. They did very little checking up. They would scare you with the fact that they can drop in and even unannounced.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that never happened. Most of the time, we didn't even get the regular visits we were supposed to have.
Let alone the surprise visit. Yeah.
So that I can picture that there's probably a lot going on in a lot of families that shouldn't be going on, or even in foster parents and approved foster families, because they don't check up as often as they ought to.
I know that I don't want to, for you to really say how your daughter is coping now that this is all over with, but you as her mother, have you observed any changes in her?
Probably more caution on her part in what she says and does. I know it just tore her heart out that, you know, someone thought she wasn't a good mother, and I really tried to support her in that. I think for the most part she's gotten over it now or gotten beyond it. They've had another baby.
Oh, good.
Their little girl is 8 months old now, but it took them a while to say, you know, should we have another child?
Yeah.
You know, and
of course.
So, but I think they have really gotten beyond all of it now. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good to hear. Deborah, is there anything that you would like to say to our listening audience before we close here? You know, maybe they know of somebody or are in the same situation, or some words of wisdom from you.
I think the best wisdom I can say is make sure you document everything. Keep a notebook, every phone call that's made, and then jot down the contents of that, you know, what was said generally in that phone call, the date and time of the call. If your child has an accident and is injured, document the injury, what happened, where they were, who else was around, so that you can have some support for saying, this is what happened to my child. This is what happened with the accident. He fell, hit his head on thus and such. It was this time of the day. Here was the action that we took. You know, in the scariness of the moment when a child is injured, you sometimes don't think of those things. But that's what you need later to prove that you didn't abuse a child, that it was an accident rather than abuse. And so I would caution parents, make sure you always know where your medical records are.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good relationship with your child's pediatrician, because they can be your best friend in saying that this child isn't abused. And things of that nature, to just keep some documentation of records of things.
You know, I'm sitting here and listening to you, documentation of every little accident they have, and it's like, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, that was as a parent of a young, when I had my children, they were young, and, you know, thinking of our son many times, but he had fallen running, like, he ran like, obviously, your grandson, and tripped over his own feet, and, you know, you just kind of pick them up and kiss it better, or if rushing down to the hospital to get stitches, because, yes, you know, there's another break on top of another break on the forehead.
Right.
And you just don't think about documenting any of this kind of thing.
And I think that's the best protection that we have, because anytime a child goes into a doctor's office with an injury, or they go into an emergency room or one of these, you know, these quickie-type clinics that are, you know, what they call critical care clinics.
But, right.
You know you need a few stitches, but you don't need to go to the emergency room.
Exactly.
And you want to be able to give those people a very good explanation of what happened so that you don't automatically become suspect.
Wow. Automatically become a suspect. You know, isn't our society in a sad place?
Yes. When I think of what happened when I was a kid and the stuff that we did...
No kidding.
Acceptable, you know.
Well, even raising my own kids, you know, I don't know how old your daughter is, but our son is 41 years old. And, you know, the falls that he had, I mean, I just never considered, or at that time not long ago, and in northern Canada, that wasn't even thought about as being a suspect.
Right, yeah, I think probably it's because we are as a society more aware of child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
There have been way too many children who've died at the hands of their parents or mom's new boyfriend or the uncle of the week or whatever.
Yeah.
And there are so many of those cases out there where children have died tragically that I think that now Child Protective Services tends to remove the child first and ask questions later in order to, you know, it's a backlash type of thing.
Yeah, and that's understandable. But, hey, there is a point where, okay, let's ask some questions.
Yes.
You know, and obviously not take 13 months and finally, and 13 caseworkers, and finally the last one that reads the case file and says, what's all this about? There's nothing here. You know, I mean, that angers me, just that fact that all those people up to that point didn't read the file.
Yeah.
Yet pointed fingers.
Yeah, exactly. And for a while, they lost our whole case file for about the papers in the file. The whole file got lost for a couple of months.
Wow.
You know, and that's the kind of incompetence that needs to be dealt with, that the agencies themselves need to be more accountable for what's going on within their ranks and make corrections there. And I think if they do that, this will happen a lot less.
Yeah. Gosh, Deborah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on this program and talking to us and explaining what you went through, but what really is going on out there, because obviously your case is not the only one, and, you know, you're bringing that up. There are other cases of wrongly accused parents or whomever of abusing a child when in fact there is no abuse. I really do appreciate you being able to talk about it, and it's so important to put this out in print and letting others know what is really going on.
And I want to thank you today too for having me on this program and for helping me get the word out there.
Well, you're welcome. And, Deborah, tell our listening audience your website address.
Okay, it's www, of course, authorsden.com, and then / Deborah K. Frontiera. And if that seems too long, they can just put Deborah K. Frontiera in a Google search, and that website will pop right up on the top.
Yes, it will. And actually, if they even just put Fighting CPS and your first name, because that's what I did, and exactly that's what came up for me. So there you go, listeners. The name of the book is Fighting CPS, standing for Child Protective Services. The subtitle is Guilty Until Proven Innocent of Child Protective Services Charges. And the author is Deborah Frontiera. And, wow, as you've heard so far, listeners, this has been really interesting, isn't it? I really encourage you to just sit back and contemplate and really look into what our system is doing or not doing. And possibly advocate and help Deborah get the word out to others and to the politicians to have them look at the system and make some changes, because in the end, it's the child that loses out. Thanks, Deborah.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
And there you go, listeners. Thanks for listening, and come again. This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.